From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
A run for your money.
You can bank on it.
Raking in the money.
Love of money is the root of all evil.
Strapped for cash?
Show me the money.
Worth one's weight in gold.
The fool and his money are soon parted.
The rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Quid pro quo.
You can take that to the bank.
You can't take it with you.
Another day, another dollar.
Money does not grow on trees.
Time is money.
More bang for your buck.
Cost a pretty penny.
Laugh all the way to the
burning
bank.
A hole in your pocket.
Your money or your life.
Why buy the cow when the milk is free?
Now that's the $64,000 question.
Just give me money.
Stop! I mean, money this, money that. What if there wasn't any money? No money at all. What would you do? Well, this hour, a look at alternatives to money. First, the end of money. That's the title of David Wolman's book on what he sees as the coming cashless society. So, I'm curious, how close are we?
Not quite yet. I would like to argue that we are in the twilight of cash, and I am trying to generate some interest in, or at least some scrutiny of cash as a method of payment and as a national obsession. But we don't quite have the perfect substitute yet that's as universally accepted and as speedy. So I don't want to rush things and be too foolhardy with my examination and my kind of disquisition about the future of cash and the questionable future of cash. But I do think that it's sort of a death by a thousand cuts situation. We just don't know yet if we're at cut number 872 or 941, but we're getting there.
I think what's surprising to the reader of The End of Money is to discover just how many alternatives there are to the kind of transaction that we've been talking about, the cash. You found all sorts of people. I think one of my favorites was, and I hope this is a made-up name, Bernard von Nothaus.
Bernard von Nothaus, that's his name. He is an alternative currency engineer. He calls himself the monetary architect. However, the federal government calls him a domestic terrorist because he created and began issuing something called the Liberty Dollar and then later the Ron Paul dollars. And he is one of these sort of gold bugs to the extreme who believe that money is only money if it has a physicality to it like real silver or real metal and real gold, et cetera. And so von Nothaus ran into trouble with the government because his coins look a lot like coins made by the U.S. Mint. However, his story on the surface sounds very zany. He's this kind of larger-than-life character. He's a real counterculture throwback who lives in Hawaii and founded the Church of Marijuana of Honolulu. And he talks about once driving a truck into a hotel lobby. And he has these incredible kind of stories. He's a wild guy to hang out with. And the Liberty Dollar and adventure sounds kind of ridiculous on the surface. And yet what I found is that when you scratch away a little bit, what von Nothaus went through and is still going through, he's still waiting to be sentenced, actually raises some very fundamental questions about what is money, what is currency, what is government-issued currency, and how much innovation with currency is permissible because we have
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think we have to talk about what the Liberty Dollar is because actually I found that what he was doing with it as you were describing it didn't sound that nutty after all. He was printing something that looked more or less like a dollar, that he called a dollar, that he used as a dollar, and if he said, I'll sell it to you for 80 cents and you can use it as a dollar. Well, as long as everybody agrees with that, what's so nutty about that?
Right. Well, some of the laws that he ran into are quite dusty and quite arcane. And one of them is that you are not allowed, I'm not going to get the precise wording correct here, but you are not allowed to manufacture notes or coins in semblance of U.S. fiat paper or metal money greater than a value of $5 or something to that extent. So he ran into a very specific counterfeiting rule. But then he also ran into some trouble because he was advertising the Liberty Dollar as competition to U.S. fiat currency. And that seems to have been a real problem for federal prosecutors. And what's interesting that I tried to get into in the book is, where is the line? Because there are Ithaca hours and there are Berkshires and there are alternative currencies here in Oregon, in Northern California, in London there's one called the Braxton Pound. And these are completely legal and legitimate as long as you don't use them to hide income, for example, from the IRS and a couple of other pretty straightforward rules, you know, especially don't make it look too much like a greenback. If you obey those rules, then these things are legitimate currencies. They don't have the aura of officialdom that we have assigned to Federal Reserve notes and coins from the mint, but they're legal. And so what I wanted to do with von Nothaus's story is explore, on the one hand, just the psychology of monetary architecture. I mean, it's one thing to be curious in what gives money value and what is currency, but then to actually go out and say, well, you know, I don't really like the system as it is. I think I'll try to innovate an entirely new approach. I think there's a lot of gumption there, and that's an interesting person, period. And then also I wanted to explore, well, what is the legal situation here? Is this guy, and is the government maybe going overboard to prosecute this guy so aggressively?
And he brings up the point that money's a fiction. Too much faith in it can bring your downfall. In fact, your chapter on Iceland illustrates that perfectly. They put all their faith in their money and went under.
Exactly. So during the financial crisis, Iceland had what is, by dollar value and per capita, the greatest banking collapse in the history of humanity. And one thing that was interesting about my reporting adventures, you know, bouncing between Tokyo and Iceland and India and Hawaii, is that you can see people's attitudes about money and currency and even the headlines in the newspapers shifting so dramatically about these issues over the course of 12 or 20 months. And what I mean by that is, in the wake of Iceland's banking collapse, everyone was talking about how Iceland really needed to get on the euro because nobody wants an Icelandic krona. It doesn't hold value. No one else is investing in it. Why on earth do these tiny little countries, the Malawi kwacha, et cetera, the Thai baht, why do these countries have their own small currencies when really they should piggyback on some larger ones, be it the euro or the dollar, et cetera? Well, then you fast forward 10 or 15 months and you have the euro crisis. And now Iceland is feeling really good that they have their corona and they are not subject to the decisions being made in Frankfurt governing the fate of the euro. And what I like about that is it's a reminder, again, that even though we think of our currency and the monetary system as kind of unquestionable and it is what it is and it works fine, you know, this is very tentative stuff and very fragile stuff that has not actually been around for that long. And, you know, I'm by no means an anarchist or anything like that. I think these are systems that we need to protect before we meddle with them too much. But it is an important reminder, especially when I went to Iceland, that, you know, our attitudes about the currency, let alone physical money, are very movable.
And yet I am, as you suggest, confident that the money the organization pays me is going to go to the bank and be honored. And when I make a transaction, the people I do that with are going to honor it as well.
Right. And in wealthier countries, of course, now most of our financial lives involve electronic money or money in electronic form, however you'd like to describe it. And the fact is that the wealthier you are, the less of a problem this is. And the more serious pivot is talking about this issue of cash being the enemy of the poor. And what I mean there is you're getting paid by your employer electronically. The money goes into the bank. You're earning interest perhaps in the bank. You are establishing good credit. Then you can get a loan to launch a small business or to send someone to school or to get a mortgage. It's all the old-fashioned, boring stuff about banking that we haven't really been thinking about of late because we have a lot of problems with Wall Street and collateralized debt obligations and other adventures. But the old-school style of banking is a great kind of social service. It helps us protect our wealth. And when you're stuck using cash, like 2 billion-plus people on the planet, you're excluded from the formal economy. And that doesn't mean the formal economy in the sense of, oh, I want you to go use a Visa card. You know, this book is hardly a Valentine to the credit card industry. It means the formal economy in that sense of getting connected to banks and earning a paycheck so that your savings can be protected in a bank and not stuffed under a mattress where someone could steal it or you could lose it in a flood. And this was a real revelation for me as someone who's not a development or economics expert to delve into this idea that cash is really expensive and cumbersome and problematic for the poor.
Well, and it does raise the question of how they would get along if cash were to disappear, because they don't have, at this point in our economy, any way to transact business without, except by saying, I'll carry out your trash if you'll give me a sandwich.
Right. And barter, you know, barter we don't want. Barter is not going to help anybody sort of buttress against future financial shock and climb out of poverty. What we need is the ability to establish savings. And what we're seeing actually because of mobile phones is a fantastic way to carry this out. It's still very early in this process, but some of the programs that I talked about in India and in Africa and elsewhere, especially in the developing world, these companies are using mobile phones as a way for people to store and send money and then even to send money to each other and then send it to a bank. And this is helping them kind of leapfrog over the need for, let's say, ATMs everywhere or bank branches everywhere, which frankly the banks are never going to go for anyway, because there's no real incentive for the banks to establish a bricks and mortar building in the slums or in the jungle. You know, what you need is a way for people to store their wealth, their savings electronically, so that, again, they're not subject to sort of the usurious rates of local lenders or this idea of hiding money under a mattress only so that a drunk family member can steal it or losing it in a flood, et cetera. And one example, and really the prime example, is in Kenya there's this program called M-Pesa, M for mobile, Pesa for money. And with M-Pesa, I think they're now up to like 13 or 15 million users in this program. And the traditional banking sector, by comparison, it took them a century to get 5 million customers in Kenya. And now you have people there who work, let's say, in Nairobi, who used to have to spend 2 days each way riding the bus to deliver some money to a relative in the countryside who needed it badly. And now what they can do is just essentially send a text message to that relative saying, you know, there's $100 waiting for you. You know, go to the local kiosk where you can essentially extract it. And cash is still part of that exchange. But in these early days, we're seeing how cash is being pushed further and further to the periphery.
David Wolman is the author of The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. Wolman is also contributing editor at Wired Magazine. What about you? You think we should get rid of cash? Even money altogether? You can email your thoughts at ttbook.org or go to our Facebook page, where you can also see what everyone else has to say. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. People do without money in many different ways, from simple bartering to using Bitcoin online. In 2005, a group of parents in Madison did it by creating a babysitting co-op. Simple. Colored popsicle sticks are traded per hour of babysitting. All the families start with a limited number of sticks, so once you're out of popsicle sticks, you have to babysit to get more. Families are added to the group and problems are discussed at potlucks every 4 months. And it's all organized online. Since 2005, the group has traded some 1,250 hours of babysitting, worth more than $15,000. But as founders Erica Monroe Kane and Ellen Carlson discovered, there is more to the co-op than saving money.
I started the babysitting co-op because after my son was born, I still wanted to be able to go out and do fun, cool things in the city that I live in, and I couldn't afford to pay for a babysitter every time I wanted to go out with my husband. And so trading sticks, popsicle sticks, to babysit each other's kids seemed like a great way for us to be able to still enjoy grown-up adult social time out in the world.
I think one of the best things about the babysitting co-op that I hadn't planned on was that my kids feel really comfortable with a lot of different families and a lot of different adults. They get to see how other people's families live. They have all these different people that they trust that I know that if something really went wrong, that I have all these different parents and adults out in the community who really care about my kids, and I know I could count on at any given time to be there and to really care about them. And they really feel like they know those people, and they feel just as comfortable with them as they do us in a lot of ways. I mean, they let them put them to bed. They, you know, hang out with them. They just really enjoy being with all these different people.
And they're friends. They're friends with the kids in the other families. So they're growing up all together in sort of a smaller community inside of a bigger city.
In a lot of ways, it's like the extended family that a lot of people used to have. My parents grew up around all their cousins and around their aunts and uncles, and those people served as parents to them, and we don't really have that anymore.
It works for all of these families. Because of the co-op, we can all go out and do interesting things and hang out with each other in the evenings and hang out with our husbands and wives and go to plays and go to art exhibits and go to lectures. And we wouldn't be able to do that without the co-op because babysitting would be too expensive for us to be able to take advantage of so many of the things that we're able to do now. The other thing is, I feel like we created it for ourselves. It works for us. And I like that sort of do-it-yourself side of it. Also, we created it for ourselves, but we've shared our bylaws with lots of people who have wanted to start their own babysitting co-op. It's something that you don't need to just keep to yourself. I mean, I'm happy to help people do this. I'm happy to help somebody else figure out how they can do it in their neighborhood. And I think that it's this kind of approach that makes, I don't know, it builds so much more. There's so much more community. There's so much more support system. There's so much more friendship than would happen without it.
That's Erica Monroe Kane. She and Ellen Carlson founded the Madison Eastside Babysitting Co-op. Currently, there are 16 families in the group, including 31 children under the age of 7. You'll find a kit to start your own babysitting co-op by going to our website at ttbook.org. Our producer, Charles Monroe Kane, is also a member of the Madison Eastside Babysitting Co-op. It got him wondering about other alternative currencies out there. Charles immediately thought about Ithaca Hours, a local currency from Ithaca, New York, that is the oldest and largest alternative currency in the U.S. Founded in 1991 by Paul Glover, Ithaca Hours has an estimated circulation of several million dollars and has spawned about 80 imitators around the country. Charles sat down with Paul Glover to find out how Ithaca Hours started.
Well, I went home and designed some prototype sample designs and began waving them at people, saying, "This is going to be money. We'll trade it with each other. Sign up here." And I gave them a clipboard, and I found within the next few months about 90 people who said, "Okay, let's try that out." They didn't say, "Well, that's a dumb idea," or "You'll get us in trouble." They said, "Well, let's try that out." And so with that initial list, published a directory and invited the whole town to join the fun.
That's amazing. It obviously has been working for more than 20 years. How deep does it work? Like, can I go to an ice cream shop, a gas station, something in downtown Ithaca and use it?
At its peak, in fact, you could buy virtually anything at all. Thousands of people and over 500 businesses, including a bank, movie theater, bowling alleys, health clubs, restaurants, the hospital, the public library, now the transit system, grocery stores at the farmers market, about 75 vendors, and so on. In fact, the only thing you couldn't buy after a certain point was health insurance, so I started a health co-op for the uninsured, which accepts the local currency as part of the membership payment.
That's fantastic. Wait a minute. You said in that list, you said a bank and the transit system. Let's just talk about the bank. How does the bank work? Like, you can deposit it?
A local credit union agreed to accept the money initially for part of its member fees and bank fees, and then I turned around and found they were accepting this money, the Ithaca Hours, for the full payment for all bank fees, and then gradually they began to accept it for part of loan repayment. So we denominated our money as hours rather than dollars. The hour has a dollar equivalency of $10, and that was the average of wages and salaries in our area 20 years ago. Professionals are entitled to charge multiple hours, Ithaca hours per hour, but it puts at the center of every transaction the idea that we're all fellow workers, fellow citizens, fellow residents of our community. And so we have found many professionals reducing their hourly rate in the spirit of the system. But it allows it to move the ethic of this kind of transaction moves voluntarily through the community. And so at its peak, Ithaca Hours transacted millions of dollars and, in fact, was beneficial to the local standard economy insofar as there was more discretionary income flowing around town and, as a result, more sales tax revenue went to government.
You know, I can imagine some folks who are active in a room agreeing to do this and getting a number of other people. I live in Madison, Wisconsin. I can see a lot of people agreeing to do this, but I'm more like the regular Joe. This just seems, I was at a bar last night and I was telling people about this interview and everyone responded, right? To, that just seems like a hassle. Like, why do it? Like, who, like, it's such a hassle. Is it really better to do this?
Well, it depends on the bar that you go to and the regular Joes you talk with, because there are a lot of regular Joes out there who don't have enough money, who need more money, and who would be happy to have. In fact, we had businesses, for example, would say, one guy particularly said, I don't care if it's marks, yen, euros. If it's money, I want it, and I'll make it work. And so he took hours enthusiastically and spent them around town quite imaginatively.
If I have I can understand, say I work with somebody and I'm going to cut somebody's grass and they pay me in Ithaca hours, I can wrap my head around that, or if I shovel snow. But if I'm actually the cashier at a grocery store and I tell my boss, hey, I want to be paid 50% in Ithaca hours or all in Ithaca hours, is that an option as well?
Yeah, there are quite a number of businesses at its peak where the employees were enthusiastically accepting Ithaca hours. In fact, some businesses said, I'll pay you $6.25 an hour, which at the time was better than minimum, or I'll pay you one Ithaca hour per hour.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
$10 bill. And so those employees who lived close to Ithaca opted for the local currency and very happily accepted the significant raise in income that that represented. As I said, you could buy pretty much anything in town with this money.
And I can imagine that there's this other side of the sword, right? I can imagine the people that start it, probably not big fans of the Starbucks and Walmart places, and those places probably don't take Ithaca hours. So when you have the increase of income, they're not getting that increase in income, only the local store is.
We never prohibited chains from participating, but they tended not to because they had chains of command beyond Ithaca. Ben and Jerry's did accept Ithaca hours for the full price of all ice cream, a very popular place to spend it. And they turned around and their employees were happy to accept it, and they spent it otherwise all around town.
Is this illegal at all? I mean, did you have feds come and investigate this? I mean, this is pretty big.
The Federal Reserve Board sent a researcher, sat on our porch. We had a lovely conversation for an afternoon. They went away and wrote a very affirmative article on our behalf. The media had contacted also the IRS, the FBI, the Secret Service, the Treasury Department, and none of them could find a law specifically against printing hours as money.
You could not have imagined, I imagine, when you started this, how successful this would be. You must have had reasons why you started this. Do you feel like you fulfilled those reasons?
I am very satisfied to have proven that on the scale of a community, us average folks can trust each other sufficiently to transact a medium of exchange, which is a representation of that trust through which we connect and multiply our capabilities. That's proven on the scale of Ithaca. In fact, during the Great Depression, 400 U.S. communities printed emergency money. To any extent that dollars don't fill the bill, we have to fill in paying the bill with local currency. So as I say it, we are making a community while making a living. Our intent is not to replace dollars, but to replace the lack of dollars. In any community where there are perceived in any sector or sectors of a community not enough dollars, then local currency fills that in.
Paul Glover is the founder of Ithaca Hours. Our producer, Charles Monroe Kane, spoke with him. Are you interested in starting your own local currency? Paul Glover has written a how-to guide. It's called Hometown Money, How to Enrich Your Community with Local Currency. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Before there was money, there was debt, boldly states David Graeber in his book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Now, Graeber brings a lot to the table. He's considered one of the world's leading anarchists. He's a professor of anthropology at Goldsmiths, University of London. And he's one of the founders of that little thing called Occupy Wall Street. Graeber says all those experiences help him understand the role of debt in our lives. Steve Paulson was intrigued. He asked why Graeber believes we can't afford to be middle class anymore, that is, without going into debt.
It has to be. You really can't pursue. I mean, you can live a basic life in terms of providing food for yourself, providing some kind of housing, maybe medical care. If there's catastrophic medical needs, it probably won't be covered. But if you want to go beyond that, if you want to send your kids to college, if you want to have some chance of advancing in life, which has become something increasingly, a prospect that seems increasingly distant to so many American families, you basically have to go into debt. And also, if you want to have a social life, I mean, what most of that money that is borrowed, it doesn't go to people's personal luxuries. It goes to things like your grandfather's birthday party, because these sort of social events are things which are not, you know, which are time sensitive. You need the money at a certain time, and that's why people go into debt, even beyond their income. You know, they say, why do they borrow the money if they could have waited? Well, usually it's because there's some pressing social need. It's your daughter is only going to be 12 once.
Well, it raises the question of whether there's always a problem with debt, or whether debt is, maybe we should just accept, this is just part of life. It's a necessary part of life, both on a personal level, because occasionally, we need the money to pay for something that we want, or at a societal level, maybe debt is necessary to fuel economic growth.
Well, I mean, that's the assumption of people like the Federal Reserve. There has to be a certain inflation rate. There has to be a certain lending rate. This is the case. The problem is that debt has an historical tendency to go out of hand. And that's especially true in historical periods like we have today. It was one of the most striking things that I discovered when I started doing a long-term history of debt is, first of all, that virtual credit money, we talk about, we're entered this domain of virtual money with cashless transactions as if this is something new, which is made possible by computers and has never existed before. What I discovered is this is not the case at all. Coinage was invented perhaps 600 BC, but you can go back 2,000 years before that and find people with fluctuating interest rates, the equivalent of expense accounts, bar tabs. People are actually using money, but money is for the most part virtual credit money. People are not actually using cash of any sort. They didn't even have coins, and they didn't even bother making scales sort of accurate enough to weigh out the tiny amounts of silver you'd have to spend if you wanted to buy a chicken or something like that. Clearly, people were doing things on credit in ancient Mesopotamia, for example. Well, you have this back and forth. Then cash comes in and you have a period of time, roughly maybe 600 BC to 600 AD, where people actually are using cash in everyday transactions. Middle Ages, it disappears. People go back to credit again. That's when the checks are invented. It's an Arabic thing, actually, check. They're using paper money in China. They're using tally sticks in Europe. So you have credit again. And around the time of Columbus, suddenly you have this infusion of gold and silver, and people go back to a bullion-based economy again. That's ending now. But it's a back and forth. Now, what you always find in periods dominated by what we would now call virtual credit money, such as we have today and have had since roughly 1971 when Nixon went off the gold standard, is some kind of mechanism to make sure things don't go out of hand and the people who do have access to credit don't end up enslaving everybody else. The great social nightmare of antiquity was exactly that, that a tiny percentage of the population would effectively reduce everyone else to slaves. They would fall into debt traps. They couldn't get out. They'd lose their lands. They'd lose their flocks. They'd have to sell their wives and children into slavery. The way to head that off was always to provide some kind of mechanism, cut things off when they started to get crazy.
Are you talking about forgiving the debt at a certain point?
Precisely. That was one of them. In the really ancient world, in Mesopotamia, they would simply cancel the debts. Often they would cancel consumer debts and not commercial debts. Every new king, often in Mesopotamia, would simply say, okay, clean slate, start over again, debts are canceled.
Well, why would they do that, though? I mean, they stand to lose a lot if they cancel the debts.
They stand to lose even more if they don't, because what would happen is society would be thrown into utter chaos. People would start fleeing their farms because terrified their creditors were going to take everything away. Large parts of the population would end up servants or slaves in other people's households. So you'd have a few rich people basically eating up everybody else, and the kings would panic. Society would fall apart. There would be unrest. People would run off and become desert nomads to escape. So really, the fear was of total social breakdown, and the dangers of slowing the economy because people would be afraid to lend money were far less than the consequences of not doing it. Similarly, biblical jubilees, they institutionalized every 7 years or 49, depending on the reading. They would simply cancel debts and start over again.
Hmm. And you've said that we should resurrect that idea of the jubilee. We keep hearing about countries that are in serious debt, and you're saying maybe it's time just to cancel those debts.
Well, I think it would be a way of reminding us what kind of world we really live in. Because another thing I discovered in looking at the history of debt is that debts are always negotiable. They're not really sacred. What they are is a promise. Now, it is true that one's honor is bound up in promises, but when you think about it, promises almost by definition are renegotiated or can be renegotiated if they are between two honorable people and their situation changes. The strange thing about debts is that once you enter, you know, once numbers enter in, once you can quantify exactly who owes what to whom and how much, they become impersonal. You don't have to think about the other person's situation, and you can transfer them. Of course, if I make you a promise, you can't give that promise to someone else, but a debt you can. In a way, that's all that money is. It's circulating promises, circulating debts. Now, when it is a matter of debts between rich and powerful people, this is what happens anyway. I mean, we saw it in 2008, of course, when AIG is several trillion dollars in trouble or whatever it was. Well, they figure something out. They play around with the numbers. They adjust things. They do something with the Federal Reserve. Suddenly, the debt's gone.
And because the assumption was that AIG was too big to let fail. I mean, there would be catastrophic repercussions if they just went out of business. So, okay, let's figure something out.
Exactly. That's the excuse. But as I say, for the really big players, that is always the case. There's always a way to work something out, readjust the numbers, play around with interest rates, play around with money production. There's a way to do it. So what you see historically is that's always the case between the big players. But it's only when you have debts between the big players and the little players, between AIG and you, that suddenly debt is treated as this sacred obligation. How could you even imagine breaking that? Hmm. Or between a poor country and a rich country. I mean, if Madagascar owes money to the U.S., that's a sacred obligation. If the U.S. owes money to China, well, we can play around with that. People are playing around with it all the time. So in a way, in 2008, they let the cat out of the bag. There were all these understandings that we had that, well, markets basically run themselves, debts are sacred obligations, the big players are these incredible geniuses who know what they're doing, and they're the only people who know how to run an economy, so just shut up and let them do their thing. And we kind of realized that none of that was really true. And I think there's a kind of democratic awakening happening, and that's what's happened in places like Spain and Greece and has spread to the U.S. There's this realization that, like, no, this isn't true. Money is just a promise. It's just a social construct. It's something we make up. If banks can lend us money, it's not because they have that money. It's because we, the people, have given them the right to make up money. Well, if that is the situation, we've given them the right to make up money because we think it'll help people have houses. It'll help the economy grow. The economy isn't growing. People don't have houses. Something went wrong. We can change that around because it really comes from us to begin with. So I think people were saying if democracy is to mean anything, it has to mean that everybody can weigh in on that process of deciding what kind of promises we make and what kind of promises we readjust when we have to do that.
Hmm. Now, you are typically identified as an anarchist, which I think in most people's minds conjures up images of chaos. You know, if you don't have a clear hierarchy of authority with leaders at the top, how are you going to get anything done? Is there an anarchist perspective on these questions of debt and income equality, inequality, and what's happening in these Occupy protests?
Well, the Occupy protests have started on anarchist principles in the sense that we believe in directly democratic process. We believe that the idea of direct action is that we should act as if we are already living in a free society, which means a society in which you don't have anybody showing up with weapons and saying shut up and do what you're told. What we find is that if people act purely on conscience and collectively, democratically, in terms of what they think is right, for example, show up at a park and say we are the public, this is a public park, we should have the right to peacefully assemble here, people with weapons will show up. It rather startles people who think they're already living in a free society. So think that it would be possible to have a free society of that sort, one which is not ultimately enforced through weapons.
Hmm. Now, it would seem that perhaps another sort of anarchist element in the Occupy Wall Street protests is, I mean, people are always asking, you know, what does this movement want? Where's the list of demands? Is that the wrong question?
Well, it is the wrong question in the sense that when you make a series of demands, what you're saying is we want to be part of the system. We are appealing to the people in power to do something for us. We want them to behave differently, but we assume that they are the people who are going to be solving our problems. The reason people held back from a list of demands at the beginning is that draws you into a certain sort of politics where you essentially get absorbed into the existing structure. Well, what the people at the Occupy Wall Street movement are basically saying as their start point is the existing structure is inherently corrupt. It's not a democratic system. It claims to be a democratic system, and I suppose it has a few moderate democratic elements. You get to vote occasionally. But really, it's a system where you select between one or two people who've already been selected by people with big money and who are ultimately going to be answerable to big money. Big money controls both political parties, and appealing to those guys is pointless.
Which raises the question then of what do these people at Occupy Wall Street want? I mean, obviously, they're pointing out what they see to be the inequity of society and of, you know, that top 1%. But where do you go from there?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is introduce the notion of what democracy would actually be like. We pride ourselves on being a democratic society, perhaps the most or greatest democratic society that has ever existed. But how many Americans have had the experience of sitting down with a bunch of other people and coming to a democratic decision together? We almost never do it. Maybe when ordering a pizza. So we're trying to introduce democratic institutions. Now, where that goes, that's a very interesting question, but it's a very thrilling thing for almost anyone. I was thrilled when I first became involved with it. I didn't realize it was possible for thousands of people to sit around and make democratic decisions. Now, in terms of what larger effects that's going to have, well, we don't want to legitimate the existing system. We want the existing system to try to legitimate itself to us. Because we're the people. We don't have to prove anything to them. Now, we're not going to do that by saying, we recognize you as the authorities and here's what we want you to do. We want to do that by saying, you have delegitimated yourself as democratic authorities. You are not that. If you want to go off and try to prove that you are, well, great. Maybe you can do that. That's what normally happens with social movements. You know, social movements that are successful don't start by coming up with a plan and then lobbying because, you know, it's totally stacked against them. What they do is they frighten the people in power with the prospect of actual democracy breaking out in this country, because nothing frightens the people running this country more than the prospect of actual democracy breaking out. If you look at the civil rights movement, which also used this sort of direct democracy, horizontal politics, civil disobedience, direct action, consensus process, it terrified the people in power and very quickly caused them to make all sorts of concessions. If you look at the anti-nuclear movement in the 70s, the global justice movement, in each case, we achieved our aims much more quickly than we expected. And it was largely because we didn't fall back on this conventional politics of lobbying our leaders to do something different. We frightened them, not by an uprising in the sense of anything violent at all, but by the prospect of real democracy and democratic institutions emerging.
David Graeber is the author of Debt, the First 5,000 Years. He teaches anthropology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and was one of the founders of Occupy Wall Street. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Imagine living an entire year without money. And I mean no money. No cash, no credit cards, nothing. Where do you live? What do you eat? How do you wash? Mark Boyle did it. And he found out it wasn't so bad after all. In fact, he loved it. He tells his heartwarming and funny story in the book The Moneyless Man. Steve Paulson spoke with Boyle about the transition from a life with money to one without it.
What I'd done was I made a list about three, four months beforehand, and I broke down every aspect of life. So you think of things like food and shelter and communications and transport first, and made a list of all those things that I currently consumed. And then obviously right away I had to stroke a few things off the list, like you can't make iPods, for example, from rose hips and nettles. So they completely went. It left me with a list of stuff that actually I could achieve. From that point onwards, I started to build either a relationship with the earth and with nature, or a relationship with somebody within my local community. So there was never any more than one degree of separation between me and what I consumed. And it gave me such an appreciation for what went into the stuff that I bought or into the stuff that I actually used from that point onwards.
Well, you say that you developed a fairly strict set of rules about what was allowed and what was not allowed, what you call your rules of engagement. I mean, obviously, no money or no checks, no credit cards. But what were some of your other rules?
I think the most important rule for me was the rule of normality, in a way, because, you know, I got inundated with questions even before I started about, you know, what would you do in this situation or that situation? Like if I went to have friends with, you know, have dinner with some friends, would I barter for dinner? And I was like, no, you know, I my friends never charged me £5 for dinner before, $5. We just cook dinner for friends and they come to me and I cook dinner for them.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing you did is you swore off fossil fuels. So you didn't have a car, and you also had some pretty strict rules about whether it was okay to even get a lift in a car. How did you work that out?
Yeah, so for me to, you know, to take a lift off people, you're still in the whole kind of game of living off, you know, somebody's buying the fuel in a way. I did hitch one time to Ireland for Christmas just because it was very important for my family for me to come home for Christmas, and there wasn't any real option given kind of the extent of my life and how time-consuming it was back then.
And you were living just outside of Bristol, England. So, I mean, this was quite a trek getting from there over to Ireland.
Yeah, it took me 2 days. The flight to Dublin takes, I think, 30 minutes from Bristol Airport, so it was a huge difference than what I was used to before. But it was, for me, it was all about an adventure. You know, I've seen parts of my own country I'd never seen before. You know, I had such amazing experiences with people, including one guy who had told me that, you know, he'd spent 2 years in prison for beating up somebody, and he'd give me a lift. And I left my water bottle in his car by mistake, my only water bottle. And about an hour after getting out of his car, he speeds up about 30 or 40 miles from where I left him, And he spent the last hour looking for me so he could give me back my bottle. And this is a guy who'd just come out of prison for 2 years. So it was some really amazing experiences just from being on the road and actually talking to people.
Hmm. And I suppose that's part of the lesson here, or what you get out of this is you have to trust people more.
Exactly. What money has become in some respects is a substitute for trust. It's now become a primary source of security in the world. And what I'm trying to do personally is to find my primary source of security in the friendships I have in my local community and in my relationship with the earth. Because, you know, as countries such as Argentina and Indonesia and currently Zimbabwe have experienced, there's hyperinflation, and you know, you can have $1 million in the bank one day, and with a devaluation, it can be almost worthless. I find that no matter how badly I behave, my friends don't devalue me that quickly. And I think real security comes in our relationships, whether to be with the planet or whether to be with our, you know, with our local community. And I think what we all can do is build a bit more diversity in how we meet our needs, to not be so reliant on cash.
Hmm. Now, let's talk about how you got your food for a moment. You mentioned that you grew some of it yourself, but that's not the only food that you ate, was it? What you grew yourself?
Yeah, I suppose you could say there is four legs to the Food for Free table. The first two are my favourite, which is growing my own, and I supplement that sometimes with wild forage food. So I hit the hedgerows and I hit the forests, and I get things like a lot of leaves and berries and nuts. But then I also do some bartering, which for me isn't ideal, but it's kind of part of the world I'm in right now, and I haven't got to the stage yet where I can grow my own grains, such as oats, and I love oats, and I live off oats in the morning, so it's quite important for me to get my oats.
So when you say you would barter, what would you give in return for getting certain foods?
Yeah, so mostly labour, so mostly I'd work for it. Sometimes if I had a glut of something, I'd have a really kind of informal relationship where I'd just, you know, go around a few other people who've got food and just chuck them in some stuff. And when they had gluts, they'd chuck me in some. So it wasn't so much bartering, more just the kind of giving away what you didn't need and then receiving when you did need something.
Now, did you also sort of scour for food that had been thrown out, dumpster diving?
Yeah, so the fourth leg of that table, effectively, I guess, is dumpster diving. And to be honest, right now, it makes up almost 0% of my diet. I still go dumpster diving, but there's a lot of homeless shelters around Bristol, which is where I live, and what we do is we just give most of the food to them. Sometimes we keep a little bit for ourselves, if I'm a bit short 1 week, but yeah, like 95-99% of the food that we find in the bins goes to people who effectively need it much more than me.
You mentioned that you use a compost toilet, and you say that the conventional toilet that we have in our society is sort of symbolizes everything that's wrong with our lifestyle. Can you explain that?
Yeah, if you look at the Indian flag, there's a spinning wheel in the middle, which was Gandhi's thing about Swadeshi, about, you know, getting back to producing his own clothing, and that's what represented independence for him. And for me, if I had an environmental flag, there would be a compost loo in the middle of the flag, because I do feel it's symbolic of the movement. I think the way we go to the loo now is very symptomatic of how we live. We do what we do, you know, we pee and we poo into our water supply, and then we blast it full of chemicals, and then we pee and we poo again and blast it full of chemicals, and so eventually we're drinking water that's got, you know, maybe thousands of revolutions of pee and poo and chemicals in it. And then we were shipping pesticides from different parts of the world to fertilize our crops. And what a compost toilet is about is getting sanity back. It's about not peeing and pooing in our water supply and keeping that fresh and clean, and doing it in the earth where we can actually make what we call human manure over here, which can actually go to fertilizing your crops, and means you effectively also don't need pesticides and fertilizers.
Now, what comes out of this whole experiment for me as I was reading your book was how time-consuming a lot of this was. I mean, for toothpaste, you concocted a mixture of cuttlefish bone and wild fennel seeds to do your laundry. would wash by hand your clothes in cold water. You made your own laundry liquid by boiling up nuts, which would take hours. Was this all worth it?
Yeah, without doubt. Like, I think you're exactly correct. Everything did take longer. And that was quite challenging, especially at the very start when I hadn't really found my routines. But everything in life consumes time. I'm even consuming time talking to you right now, which is quite a pleasurable way to consume time. But yeah, so I think I felt that what was important to me in life, I was kind of asking myself, was it to continue watching kind of the mind-numbing programs I was watching beforehand? Or was it, you know, I felt that there's a really beautiful way to live, a really gentle way to live. And I actually really started to enjoy my time out in nature, whether it be growing the food or cycling or washing my clothes in the outdoors or cooking outdoors. I started to really, really enjoy those moments, you know, where it's really dark at six o'clock in the evening in the winter, and all you can see is the moon coming up over the horizon and the birds starting to go quiet and the breeze in your face and sometimes the rain. Like, I really started to embrace that, and at the start I thought I would hate it, to be honest. You know, it was a million miles away from where I came from. But I think it's just about what your priorities are, and now my priorities in life aren't, you know, obviously aren't the same as what they were before. They're now about working with nature, about living as gently as possible.
What's been the hardest part of this whole enterprise of living without money?
I think you struck on one of them, which is the time constraints. I think I'd be lying if I said that there wasn't the odd time where, you know, I thought it would be nice to come into the trailer and have the central heating already on, you know, and instead of having to do half an hour's work before it even got remotely warm. But I think probably the other aspect is the world around me and the social aspect. You know, where I live in a world where my friends and family all use money, and so they socialise using money. And I guess it brought up a lot of male ego issues for me. You know, I grew up in Ireland, and you're almost fighting at the bar to be the first person to buy a round. You know, it's that kind of culture. And I got to a point where actually I couldn't even buy myself a drink, let alone my friends. And that was really difficult for me at the start. You know, it kind of grated at who I was, at what my identity was at that point. But I think you work through that stuff eventually. And now I'm at a point where, you know, I make my own beer now. I make my own cider. My friends come out far too regularly to me. I can't get stuff done sometimes because they enjoy it so much, and they drink all my beer and cider. So I'm quite happy. Not that sometimes I just think, ease off it, guys. Ease off it here. This is gonna last me 3 months, and they're necking through it, you know, in 2 hours. So it's really that's kind of solved some of my issues. Is starting to produce all my own stuff and to be able to give. To be able to give again is quite important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you the best of luck. I find this very inspiring, your story.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on. It's been great.
Mark Boyle chronicled his experiment in the book The Moneyless Man, A Year of Freakonomic Living. But he didn't stop there. 2 years later, he's still doing it. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information on The Other Money, please go to our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a wealth of past interviews with great thinkers, creators, and agitators. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Anne Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.